a huge nerd with anything that was related to science. And I ran across the Hubble Deep Field image of 10,000 galaxies. And it completely changed my perspective. And I found an astronomy club in my hometown in Marblesville. And so I joined it at a star party that I accidentally ran across. I think I was about 13. And I was the only youth member at the time. If we want to evolve as a civilization, we need to expand our knowledge. And with, you know, crafts like this, it's changed the world. And imagine what, you know, James Webb will do and the one after that.
Abigail Bolenbach, a student, science communicator, and astronomy club organizer who got the astronomy bug early in life and tells us her story of how she got turned on to astronomy, as well as some of the projects that she's working on. We also take some time to talk a little bit about the Cassini mission to Saturn. She's also the host of the Astronomy Magazine video series Infinity and Beyond. So let's get started. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Space Junk, a weekly podcast dedicated to the amazing hobby of amateur astronomy. Each week, we'll bring you interesting and fun discussions with an eye towards providing you with the latest information and advice on the tools, gadgets, software, and techniques for maximizing your enjoyment of the night sky. Your hosts are Tony Darnell from deepastronomy.space and Dustin Gibson from OPT Telescopes, a world leader in telescopes and accessories.
We've been talking about this, Abigail, for a long time. So welcome. We're finally making
Thank
time
you.
For this.
Yes, welcome, Abigail. Fun. Okay, is it Abby or Abigail? Which one?
Well, you can call me Abby. Abby's totally fine. But if you want to call me Abby Normal, that's okay too.
Okay, Abby Normal. So I'm really glad to have you here because there's so much that you're involved in that I think our listeners would like to learn a little bit about. So you are a science communicator. You're an ambassador for telescope companies and you do a lot of science outreach and things like that. You're also a host of a video series called Infinity and Beyond, which I guess is something Astronomy Magazine is putting out. So tell us a little bit about yourself and what you're doing.
So where do you want me to start?
At the beginning?
Okay. So at the big bang of it all. So
that's
kind
right.
of how the little seed of interest that I have for astronomy kind of was planted into my psyche was just from one image. And it was kind of like a butterfly effect in a sense. Because I was, and still am, speaking in past tense, a huge nerd with anything that was related to science. And I got any National Geographic magazines that I could get my hands on. And so I had like three or four sitting on my front doorstep. And I'd like scurry out whenever I'd hear the mailman drop them on my porch. And I'd, you know, come in and read for like 4 or 5 hours just on my carpet. And I ran across the Hubble Deep Field image of 10,000 galaxies. And it completely changed my perspective and basically path for life. I knew immediately that that's what I wanted to do. I was instantaneously hooked. At 10 years old, I knew that that's
wow.
what I needed to do, what I was meant for, and thus blossomed my love for astronomy. And before that, I was onto dinosaurs. So I wanted to be a paleontologist. And they just went away. They were like an afterthought. They were my ex.
Yeah. Dinosaurs are definitely
astronomy.
Past tense.
Yeah. So at the ripe old age of 10, I did anything I could possibly, you know, get my hands on that was astronomy related and space. And of course, wore my enthusiasm. So I had like got this whole new wardrobe with space related clothes. And I looked like a total freak show. an enthusiastic one though. And I found an astronomy club in my hometown in Marblesville. And so I joined it at a star party that I accidentally ran across. I think I was about 13 and I was the only youth member at the time. So I immediately got involved in any educational public outreach with them. I proceeded to assist with anything I could at public star parties, volunteering with other club members, you know, helping other children because children relate better with each other, view through telescopes, and even safely looking at sunspots. But I think within about a year of joining, I actually started as a presenter for the Bartlesville Astronomical Society. So I wanted to get over my fear of public speaking because I knew that one day I was going to be running NASA and I needed to start early. And so I decided, okay, well, I got to start now. It's going to be a long run. Might as well get over this fear. So I started providing monthly summaries of current astronomy news. And of course, later larger topics, you know, like such as like famous rocket crashes, or how to make an astrophotography tracking mount, biologies of different types of stars, different constellations, and more and more. And of course, my baby, the Cassini-Huygens legacy, which we'll be talking about later on. So I just kind of threw myself into this and learned as I was going. It wasn't like I read an instruction book. And so I made mistakes and grew. But after about 5 years of doing my little news segments, I became more comfortable with, you know, the knowledge that I was acquiring, and I retained that information, and I was able to give it to people in a better sense. And I wanted to give it to kids. I wanted to share my passion and knowledge with other kids that might be interested in astronomy and just make it more accessible. So I think it was in 2016, whenever my mentor and I organized the Bartian Youth Astronomers. So I think, and we've got around 40,000 people in Bartlesville. We formed the first non-school affiliated youth astronomy club in the country, as far as we can find still to this day. Yeah. So it's own thing. It's crazy. This just goes to show we need more exposure to science and space for everyone, including kids. But we started outlining everything. The sky was the limit, basically, and beyond, of course, with different projects and workshops and everything like that. But we had our first meeting in 2016, and it grew to about, I want to say, like, we have 25 members now, 25 or 30. So, and a lot of them are actually homeschoolers.
What's the age range there?
Very young, which is wonderful. Starting that exposure at an earlier age, I think our average age is about, I want to say 9 to 11.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, I think our youngest one is 4 or 5. And they're not even an official member. They just are accompanying their older siblings. And he actually knows Cassiopeia. He can spell it. He can point out in the sky to me. It's his favorite. It's phenomenal.
Yeah, it is important to get the, you know, kids involved. And we see that on the imaging side as well. I mean, more and more, I'm being blown away by kids that are 10, 11, 12 years old taking these images that you would think that, you know, it's people that have been doing this 20 years and posting some of the best stuff I'm seeing to Instagram and other outlets. And so on both sides of it, not just, you know, the hobbyist astro imaging side, but also the science side and getting kids involved. I do think it's important. I mean, you said you were into dinosaurs. You know, their story probably would have worked out a little differently if they had gotten their kids involved in astronomy.
They didn't get enough science education.
Yeah, their near Earth object program was garbage.
Yeah,
that's right, man. They did not look up enough for sure.
Yeah, the dinosaurs sucked at astronomy.
Yeah, well, well. So Bartlesville is in Oklahoma, right?
Yes.
What are the skies out like out there? Are you wide open spaces kind of place, or is it a big city? What kind of skies do you guys have out there?
So Bartlesville is a smaller town, and we've got some outskirts. So there is a place near Pawhuska where we do some viewing as groups. That all the members will get together. And then there's a couple other little places around the outskirts of town where some members live, that it's a darker site where we'll kind of have like little star parties. But we generally congregate at some of our state parks too. So we've got Osage Hills State Park, and we've got a Washashie Cherokee Park. And it's been a wonderful place for viewing and imaging. It's a lot darker than all of the light pollution around our town. But otherwise, that's about as far as we journey from Bartlesville as a group on a regular basis.
Yeah, out in the Western Plains, it can be quite amazing, really nice dark skies out there. So I was just curious about that. Now, the you're a little kid when you first go there. You're excited about astronomy. You're going to an astronomy club that you've never gone before. How were you received there? What was the what was the welcome like, or what was your impression of that grouping of people?
Okay, so I love my group now. And they love me. They have grown to love me. I forced them.
Oh, that doesn't sound right. They grew.
At first, it wasn't a very inviting and warm relationship with this astronomy club. Because I was so young, I just seemed probably to them being veteran, physicists and mathematicians and engineers that were doing their hobby. I was invading their, relaxation because I wanted to know. I was curious. I was an annoyance, and I pestered because I wanted to acquire more knowledge, and I asked too many questions. But I was also a girl, and there were only two other women in the club, and one was this secretary, I do believe, and the other one I thought was one of the wives for the longest time, but then she liked to look through binoculars, and so she kind of was a club member. There were a couple other women that joined after that, but out of, 50 members, it was mostly men, and I was like the only kid. And so my mentor reached out to me after I'd persisted and been there for about a year and knew that I was steadfast in doing this and I wasn't giving up. I obviously wasn't going away, and so I was committed. So he was like, okay, well, I guess we can go ahead and I'll help you. And he was very helpful and helped kind of encourage my love and passion for it and kind of put me under his wing, which really, if he hadn't done that, that little bit of encouragement, it could have just, sweltered my whole little, bonfire love for astronomy. That flame could have just been put out because they weren't very open. It was a very exclusive group. So after I'd been there for about 2 years, and mind you, I've been presenting now for about a year, and I've gotten up there in front of a crowd that did not want to hear what I had to say because I was this little shrimp, and how could I know, all the stuff that I was talking about? And they finally kind of respected my resilience and tenacity, and they started enjoying some of it. And then that little group, the safe group circle that supported me, turned into about 10 people, and then 12, and then about 15. And then after I'd been there for about 3 years, they're like, oh, wow, she's pretty sharp. And then everybody kind of became an Abby fan, and I really appreciated that. I don't hold it against them because the majority of people that I've ran into this field, they're very Spock-like logical personalities. So they don't appreciate personable interactions, and they think it's pointless or whatever. But for a child, it's imperative. And I'm thankful that I am stubborn-headed enough and I got through it. But now
Spock-like personality type. That's a first. That's a first. But I know exactly what you're talking about.
Yeah, that is a great story. I mean, good, and kudos to both you and your mentor. I want to hear a little bit about him or her. Tell us about your mentor, because, that would have been a tragic story had that person not been there, it sounds like. And Dustin and I talk about this a lot on this podcast about how astronomy clubs, you want to tell people to go to them, but they're not always the friendliest places to go. And I call them harumphers. and they just, harumph, harumph, harumph. With everything new that tries to happen in their club, they want things the way they want them, and they don't want anything to change.
No change.
I mean, can you tell us a little bit about the role your mentor played and just how important it was to you, not just for this astronomy club, but it sounds like your mentor's gotten you into other avenues as well.
Well, he was an amazing person, but we all kind of outgrow our roles. And whenever he was like the key stepping stone for me to understand that I was capable of doing this, that it was a field that I could do, and that it was possible for me to do. And he opened my eyes for that and helped me so much along the way, building many, many different things, helping me observe. And I gained more mentors after him in the group and outside of the group that helped me too. But sadly, one of my beginning mentors, like you see a lot in college, whenever a student outshines the other mentor, it was not a very healthy position. They actually discouraged my love and interest in pursuing astronomy and suggested that I just go into piano. I'm also a pianist. And they said, well, you know, there's not many jobs in this field. You should really seriously consider.
Are you serious? They said there's not many jobs in astronomy.
Yeah. And, wow. And I was, you know, he knew that I wanted to go into astrophysics or any, you know, cosmology related field that I was, you know, accepted into. And I do piano to kind of escape, really. And that's kind of a funny way to look at it, because reading music is very stressful. yes. I've been doing it for, you know, 12, 13 years now. So it's gotten easier-ish, but it is. It's my avenue to just kind of escape the world and relax. But I don't want to do it as a profession. And whenever you look up to someone, that type of discouragement, whether, you know, at the time it was meant to be extraordinary damaging or not, it still was. And those unintended consequences sometimes can be fatal to a child's spark. And luckily mine was not, because I am tenacious and very stubborn.
No kidding. It sounds like you've overcome a lot, just a lot of negative reactions just to get where you are now. So good for you. Okay, so let's transition a little bit now to you've gotten introduced with your local astronomy club, and you've been, you know, been presenting there. You've obviously got a passion for astronomy and space, but you seem to have a special affinity for Saturn and the Cassini mission. Do you want to talk a little bit about first why you have that passion, and then tell us a little bit about the Cassini mission?
So sadly, why I was obsessed with Saturn was before I got interested into astronomy, and I was into astrology. And I regrettably have to say that that's what actually originated my love for Saturn, because I am a Capricorn and it was my planet. And therefore, I connected with it and loved any random factoids about Saturn. And I just always felt that it was kind of my pet planet. I'd always go to Saturn if I was bored or anything like that. And then whenever, of course, I saw the light and was enlightened came to the light side, I left the dark side and went to astronomy. I appreciated Saturn much more. And when I had the opportunity to speak at MISRL, the Mid-States Astronomical Region, in 2018, someone came and saw one of my talks here in Bartlesville at my club and wanted me to present there. And she was a fantastic mentor and helped me get many, many places. And so I was really, really nervous and I didn't know what to talk about, but I had done a Cassini-Huygens legacy presentation for my club. And so I just fleshed it out and practiced. And as I kind of immersed myself in this kind of Saturn therapy, if you must call it, I just discovered I was totally obsessed. And I presented this presentation at the MISRL, and then I presented it also several other places, but I actually did a lecture on it in the Tulsa Astronomy Club at the planetarium there. And I collaborated with the planetarium director, Dan Zielinski. He is just a great man. And that was such a wonderful experience, because he wanted to create a planetarium show with me. And so a year later, it debuted. It's wonderful. It was such a cool learning process to work with the equipment behind the scenes and see how to actually do a planetarium show, let alone the process. It was great, but I had to crunch down, you know, this like hour and a half lecture into kind of a 20 to 30 minute presentation up on a dome. And it was really, really great. So to just kind of put myself out there, if you guys want to go see After the Pandemic, From Earth to Saturn is what the planetarium show is named.
And what's the name of the, and it's what was the planetarium again?
The Jinx Planetarium.
That has a special part in my heart because I cut my teeth on planetary. I grew up in a similar situation, and I spent a lot of time in a school district planetarium in Boulder, Colorado. And I got to work at Fisk Planetarium there, as well as the Tombaugh Planetarium down in New Mexico. And I just love being under a dome, both telescopic and, you know, planetarium dome. So I definitely have an affinity for that story. That's great. So, So what is it? What did Cassini do for us then? What is when is tell us a little bit about the mission to the mission.
Yeah, this
to
is always my favorite part because like I don't, you know, they call it astro imaging, right? But really, it should be imaging astro, because all we really end up talking about is photography and the tools to do photography. But the astro piece of it comes secondary in most conversations. If you look at the forums, you'll find that this is that piece comes secondary. So even if you're taking pictures of Saturn, you're not talking about Saturn. You're talking about how do I get the sharpest image of this object. So I always like this part in our podcast where I get to learn something new about the astro side of it, because it's not typically part, it's not the leading part of the conversations in astro imaging.
Yeah, that's a good point. So yeah, tell us a little bit about Cassini then.
So first, just kind of the true legacy of Cassini really lives in the mountains of data that scientists are going to be studying for decades to come. There was actually 2.5 million commands executed, over 600 gigabytes of science data collected. I think there was almost 300 Saturn orbits. There were over 150 targeted moon flybys. Almost 500,000 images were taken. There were almost 200 main engine burns. I mean, we discovered two oceans on Titan and Enceladus. Hundreds of small lakes were discovered. It was a phenomenal mission. We had the four-year primary mission, the two extended missions, the Equinox mission from 2008 to 2010, and then the Solstice mission from 2010 to 2017. It was just an extraordinary endeavor, and I have only covered and touched on a small fraction throughout my lust for learning more about it. Really, though, I don't even know where to start.
So what about these oceans? I didn't know that. I didn't know that there were two oceans discovered on Titan. What are these oceans of?
So the oceans are actually, I do believe, methane. So there's propane lakes, there's liquid hydrocarbon, ethane, methane, lakes on there, but there's also vents of cryovolcanoes.
So Tony, so Titan would be like a no smoking zone.
Yeah.
Yeah. And very stinky too. It'd be very, very, it would not be a place you'd want to like get fresh air at all.
No, you don't go surfing in those oceans.
But one of the great things about the Cassini mission is that it coupled with it was a lander that went down on Titan, descended onto the surface and through the atmosphere, the Huygens probe. And, as it descended, it took some images, and I think some video, but, there
it
were
did.
Definitely some clear images of
it. Did it was near the Xanadu region. Actually, it was the first landing on a moon other than our own, which is just extraordinary to think of, really. But it actually parachuted down onto land, although the possibility that it would touch down in an ocean was also taken into account in its design. But the probe was designed to gather data for a few hours in the atmosphere and possibly a short time at the surface, which it did. But it actually continued to send data for about 90 minutes after touchdown. So it exceeded our expectations of it. Measurements of the winds were possible by studying how the molecules present in the moon's atmosphere moved. This was actually achieved by the faint infrared light that they emit. So what Huygens traveled through was actually Titan's alien nitrogen atmosphere. And based on computer modeling of the atmosphere and based on the winds, it revealed that its system was like a giant conveyor belt circulating the wind from north to south and south to north. And in images, we see that Titan has a hazy, thick atmosphere, but Huygens, being there, you know, of course, found it to be even hazier than expected due to the presence of aerosols or dust particles. But actually, one thing that was really cool is scientists were surprised to find that two noble gases, xenon and krypton, were not found at all. There was no signs of them. But measurements of the atmosphere confirmed that the complex organic compounds, the building blocks of amino acids necessary for life, were present in both gas and solid phases, which was one of the main keys why we released Huygens there. But despite the atmospheric haze on board, the cameras on board the Huygens probe, you know, experienced, they were able to take clear images of Titan's surface. And the first image of the surface showed a world that really resembled Earth in many ways, with evidence that liquid methane had flowed on the surface, causing erosion. It weather it measured, I think, weather conditions at the surface of temperatures of like minus 170 degrees Celsius, and it only had about an atmospheric pressure slightly higher than Earth's. But the video was epic watching it come down because it was clear, it was beautiful, there was no glitching. Ah, what I would have been to have seen that live. It would have been phenomenal.
Yeah, I'm sitting here trying to remember what the temperature was on Titan. Do you have that? Do you know what that is off the top of your head? What the average temperature on the surface is?
Yeah, it's a minus 170 degrees Celsius.
Ooh. Okay, so that's pretty. Yeah, that's pretty cold. So cold. Yeah. So there are some pluses and minuses here for life. You mentioned the building blocks for the amino acids, and then there's, which themselves are building blocks of more organic, complex organic molecules. So life, while I don't know, improbable, certainly might arise on Titan. Any idea? What do you think about that? Do you think there might be at least some simple organisms down there?
They actually have hope that there is, because aren't they sending Dragonfly to Titan?
Yes, they are.
That's
Dragonfly,
right.
Dragonfly is this awesome quadcopter that they're sending out to Titan.
You're always talking about this quadcopter.
Hey, dude, come on.
I think it's awesome. I don't understand why. So maybe you guys can explain this to me, but why Titan over something like Europa? Why are we so invested already in Titan before being invested in something like Europa? Europa seems to make a ton of sense.
I'm not sure we are more invested in Titan. I think
even distribution of love between the two, because they're sending, they're figuring out the technology right now so that they don't damage the surface. And if there is life trying to find it on Europa, because they've got to do a submarine. And right now they're thinking of lasering down or dropping a semi-type explosive, which to me just seems really detrimental. But
well, even if it's not Europa, just anything, I mean, it's such a big gap. You just said, you know, the second place we ever landed something after the moon, or landed on another moon after ours, was Titan. Titan's a long way away. Why is Titan chosen as the primary target for something like that? You got to pass a lot of other moons, you know, on your way to get there. Why is Titan chosen over everything?
Because it's a Titan. It rules. I don't know, actually, particularly that question, because I'm sadly not sitting in the desk at NASA making those decisions. I think just because it has such dynamic to it and likelihood that there is or was possible life on just like Europa, and also Enceladus, which to me, I really, 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 really want them. And I think, I'm not sure specifically right now, but they were going to send something to Enceladus. Because beneath the icy shells of Enceladus, scientists believe that oceanic hydrothermal vents must exist. And if those do exist, then that means that there could be life. If there was, with the Doppler effect, and everything else combined with that moon. It's like a perfect harbor for, you know, ancient sea creatures, which to me just shows more and more evidence suggesting a habitable ocean. I want there so badly to be a mission going there first. But I'm just particularly biased.
Well, that was, yeah, just to fill that out, you know, follow up on that, you know, one of the reasons we were so interested in Titan to begin with going out there was that we knew a priori that that was a moon that had an atmosphere. And so right. We definitely wanted to check that out. One of the things Cassini taught us that we did not know prior to going there was what Enceladus was actually like. I mean, they flew through water plumes. And they did not expect that. That was a huge surprise. So then all of a sudden, after Cassini arrived, Enceladus became, whoa, we got to check this out. And so now there is a lot of intense interest. I'm not saying it's going away from Titan because we're sending Dragonfly there, but Enceladus is a big target as well, especially as Abby points out, we want to get the you know, these water plumes figured out, the subsurface oceans, if there are any.
To actually expand on that, there's four huge ice fissures called Tiger Stripes in Enceladus. And what that is jets of salty water and ice shoot from over 100 geysers in these ice cracks from an underground ocean beneath the icy crust of Enceladus. And these geysers shoot out at approximately 800 miles per hour, creating the hazy E-ring for Saturn. And some of the material falls back into Enceladus, and some extend hundreds of miles into space, like I said, to form the ring. But Cassini flew through this, and nanoparticles of silica were detected in the icy droplets of the E-ring. And, you know, silica can only be generated when rock and liquid water interact at temperatures higher than 90 degrees Celsius. So that also points, you know, There's got to be something there underneath.
I don't know that we have any missions currently slated to go to Enceladus. I mean,
I know that's
with
why
Dragonfly and then the Europa Clipper, those two are on the books, but I don't know if there's anything that's been approved yet to go to Enceladus. But like you say, Dustin, it's far. It's a long way to go. So
it is.
So I hope we can get some more stuff out there. So do you have it? What's your favorite? Let me not ask it that way. I want to know the biggest surprises that you think that came out of the Cassini mission. One of them, I think, was Enceladus. I think that was a big surprise. But what do you think were the biggest?
I think, well, okay. So I can give you a couple things. So the first thing that I think was so cool was the Royal Crown. The hexagon.
That's a good
streams.
Cola, man. I love RC. Sorry.
Crown Royal.
Yeah.
The hexagon at the North Pole was first revealed by the Voyager mission in the early 80s, but Cassini observed this behemoth storm during Saturn's winter when it was in shadow, and it discovered that it was 20,000 miles across with wind speeds reaching 200 to 300 miles per hour. So each of the cloud's six sides is about 8,600 miles long. That is longer than the diameter of the Earth at almost 8,000. It's like 7,900 and change. But this storm could just swallow up Earth, and we didn't really understand how big it was. So that's the first thing. And then the second thing would probably be the storm cycles. So the 30-year storm cycle actually serendipitously appeared 10 Earth years early. So basically the phenomenon roared for two-thirds of an Earth year and wrapped 200,000 miles around Saturn. And basically what it is it's everything coming up from the depths of Saturn up to the top, kind of having a hissy fit. If you could just imagine us excreting our toxins through, you know, acne, in a sense, is the same way that Saturn does this with its 30-year storm cycle. And but for Saturn, it's like an annual occurrence because the long, I think, 29.5 Earth years is one Saturn year. this season, if you must, would be like 7 Earth years long. So just imagine going through your hormonal stage for 7 years. That sounds miserable. But also from that, we get the lightning. And oh, I love the lightning. It's so cool. They finally kind of heard it. The Cassini's sensors heard it in the form of radio waves. But finally, cameras actually captured the image of Saturnian lightning for the first time with Cassini. And it's just absolutely monstrous.
And the ending of the mission was pretty spectacular too. The way
it was,
one of the things I love about NASA, I often talk a lot of crap about NASA, but it does a lot of amazing things too. And one of the things that I am constantly amazed with, one of the reasons I'm skeptical is I'm following James Webb Space Telescope and I'm just waiting if that thing is ever going to get launched. But when missions do get launched and when they do get deployed, they tend to get way more than their money's worth out of these things.
Yeah, that's true.
And certainly Cassini. Yeah. And so Cassini certainly filled the bill when even to the point of how they were going to crash it into the planet. They wanted to have data all the way up until the very end. And so they sent this thing. Describe for us a little bit about the ending of the Cassini mission.
Sure. So it was kind of like the final frontier. So the final mission actually concluded with a 5-month grand final phase. And that's the official title. So there were actually 22 deep dives between Saturn's clouds and innermost rings. And there was an image that was taken called the Mosaic, and it was named the most ridiculous and absurd name I've ever heard. I'm still insulted for Cassini. It was called the Noodle. Imagine the last image that you took was called a noodle. That kills it for me. But anyway, Cassini did capture the dive, and it was very sad, but noble in a sense. But for the final dive on September 15th in 2017, operators actually deliberately plunged the spacecraft into Saturn. And like you said, Cassini gathered science until the very end and was such a team player. But Cassini kept the spacecraft antenna pointed at Earth to send as much data as possible. And they didn't actually intend for this to happen, but they programmed it on the fly, which that to me is like phenomenal freestyle. We need to do this. We didn't think about that. But
yeah,
that's another
kudos to NASA. Yeah.
Yeah. The plunge actually ensures Saturn's moons will remain pristine for future exploration, uncontaminated by hitchhiking microbes from Earth, which is really important because if we actually manage to get our butts out there onto a moon and see that our life has evolved with something else, I think that would be a very scary and uncomfortable situation.
Yeah, I'm really glad you said that, because why they did it was pretty important. Wanted to make sure it didn't contaminate the area with accidentally crashing into something else once they lost control of it. They did the same thing with Galileo and Jupiter, where they got rid of it that way as well. So, but Galileo had a lot more, it was hampered a lot more than Cassini was technically, because of its had problem with the dish antenna. So they weren't able to do with Galileo what they ended up doing with Cassini. And it was spectacular. You're right. It was an amazing ending to an amazing mission. I mean, that thing was up there for a long time.
Yeah.
And we're still, as you pointed out at the top, they're still going to be going through this data. How many gigabytes? I mean, 600 or 800 gigabytes of data?
Yeah, over 600 gigabytes.
That's a lot of stuff to pour through. So there's still a lot more to learn. And so many of NASA's missions are like this. Kepler, same thing. Kepler mission still giving data that they're still discovering planets from that freaking thing. So, and it's been off now for, I think, 3 years. So they're still going through that stuff.
The historic Cassini mission was really an adventure full of unprecedented discoveries. And like you said, while the mission is complete, its enormous body of data will continue to rewrite textbooks for decades to come. And what I always tell people is the Cassini orbiter should not be thought of as simply a sophisticated collection of propulsion mechanisms, sensors, and microprocessors. Scientists and engineers viewed this thing as their baby, and so did I. But they view such a craft as extensions of our limited human perceptions. And this is always one of my strongest arguments to people that approach me with, well, we spend too much money on this and exploring space. We need to resolve our problems here on Earth. And I do completely understand and agree that our way isn't exactly the best that we've been doing this. But still, if we want to evolve as a civilization, we need to expand our knowledge. And with, you know, crafts like this, it's going to change. It's changed the world. And imagine what, you know, James Webb will do and the one after that.
Right. So just to really drive that home, think about this for a second. The thing was up there for almost 20 full years.
Yeah.
Okay. So you're young. You're just starting out your career. A lot of NASA people working on the Cassini mission started their careers on this mission because way before launch, which was, I guess, 97, way before that, 10 years prior, they start planning it. They start building it, designing it, and all of that stuff. So you're looking at 30 full years. That is a career. Right. And imagine that you start with Cassini and then you help all the way from the beginning and then you see it launched. And then 20 years later, it crashes into the planet to end its mission. I mean, that is the scale over which we're talking about here. And that you know, you yourself may be deciding where you're going to work. You said you were going to be involved in NASA. Let's say you get involved in a project that's just getting started out. The Hubble Space Telescope started in 1980 and is still going.
Yes.
these are career moves on this. And there's nothing, I think, this hasn't happened very often, thank goodness. But when, you know, they blow up at launch or if, you know,
the mission never gets fails, off
the pad.
That's just tragic, right?
When you're putting a decade into something, or in it's an entire career plan for a single project. Yeah, can you imagine watching that thing explode on the pad?
No, I don't even want to. I need to go to therapy just thinking about it.
So Abby, I want to know how did all of this stuff lead to, because clearly, like, you have a fascination with this, you have a passion for this. I would imagine even when this podcast ends, you're still going to be talking about this. Like, you love this conversation. That's awesome. That's how it is with all astronomy people. I feel like that's why we all get along so well. But how did all of that lead to, you know, now you're doing videos for Astronomy Magazine? You want to talk about that?
Sure. Yeah. So really why I kind of wanted to talk about Cassini today is because it really was what jump-started my journey. Because I did that presentation at the Mid-States Region Astronomical League convention, and it was at Explore Scientific, and Scott Roberts saw me, and we became wonderful friends. I love Scott so much, and he saw something in me and supported me through so much and gave great encouragement. And I am now an Explore Scientific ambassador and absolutely love it and love working with him. But from that, I met so many people that were so loving and encouraging and just thought I was really inspiring. And it was kind of new energy that I was experiencing because I hadn't run into that before. It was like, oh, wow. So it's like, okay, to be a space nerd, like, I'm not infringing on anyone's ego. Like, you, it's okay, really? Oh, wow, cool. Okay, awesome. And it just exploded from there with, you know, positivity and wonderful support from so many different people. And I got the Horkheimer's Award, the Astronomical League's Horkheimer Award in 2018 for my efforts in astronomy outreach. And then I didn't stop. I did the solar glasses program with Astronomers Without Borders and Sugar Creek Astronomical Club. I had my club sort through about 50,000 glasses, and we sent them to South America to safely view the total solar eclipse. That was in July 2019. That was a fantastic opportunity to participate in. In 2019, I was actually selected as one of 24 young students worldwide to be recognized as part of the Mars Generation, second class of 24 under 24 leaders and innovators in STEAM, which I totally freaked out when I found out I was part of that So, of course, STEAM is science, technology, engineering, arts, and math. But those are the fields that are bringing the sciences to the public through, you know, multidisciplinary interests. And then later, like I said, Scott gave me the honor to be his one of his Explore Alliance ambassadors. And I've spoken in so many different places and gotten to meet so many awesome people, like at the Nebraska Star Party. And then I went to the St. Louis Astronomical Society and talked about pulsars and quasars, which became the new kind of soulmate. It took Saturn's place momentarily, and thus has blossomed my love for black holes. But I actually did the pulsars and quasars talk online for Scott with the Explore Alliance ambassadors. That's where David Eicher saw me with Astronomy Magazine. Oh, okay. And it's connections like that. They just cascade.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's fantastic. And so in April, I did, like I said, an online presentation. And I just talked really about, you know, radio astronomy, some of the aspects of spectroscopy and the nature of anatomy of quasars and pulsars. And David messaged me afterwards and wanted to do an interview. And I was like, oh, my God. Astronomy Magazine contacted me. This is so cool. Yeah. And I had my freak out moment. And after we met over the online, I think it was like a Zoom interview meeting type thing. It was with the other editors. I came out with my own series with them. And I just am still elated. It's hard for me to believe that such a serendipitous opportunity just came from that. I'm still ecstatic, but that's just kind of basically where I'm at today, just winging it. And so many awesome people pushing me along and helping me push the envelope.
First, congratulations, because yes, it is. It's a huge opportunity, and I think a lot of people would trade places with you to have that opportunity. So it is a huge opportunity. It's really cool, and I know it's developed you a following and is only going to continue to do that. And having people like Scott Roberts in your corner, there's nothing wrong with that at all. I can tell you,
no.
You know, Scott and I, we try to have serious conversations too. It never happens. Not once. It's never happened. So congratulations on that as well, because if you've achieved getting the serious conversation with Scott Roberts, you've done something. Something
incredible. Thank you, Dustin.
Yeah.
But serious conversations aren't very fun, and they don't, generally the best conversations that I've had are the creative ones. Serious.
Yeah, well, I agree.
That stagnates. Dies.
I agree. And that's why, you know, I think that between Tony and myself, we've probably spent 7, maybe 8 lifetimes in astronomy clubs, you know, different clubs around the country, around the world. We've spent a lot of time in clubs. And let me tell you, like, you know, we started the conversation with this, but here's how I feel about the two different types of clubs that I see. And one that I very much appreciate, and one that I always try to find somebody that's vulnerable within the club to start the revolution, right?
And Viva so, la revolution.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like you will change this club, but it's like, here's what I see with two different types of clubs. You have the club that celebrates knowledge, and then you have the other club that celebrates what do you think. And what I like about the What Do You Think clubs is it implies progress and it implies moving forward. When you're asking somebody, what do you think if? What you're saying is, where do we go next? What do we pursue? What are we going to challenge ourselves with? When all you do is celebrate and recycle the facts that you know, what you're saying is we're past the finish line looking back. And there's nowhere to go from there but just to bicker and argue about who knows more. And those clubs are the ones that I think that when we talk about our frustration, those are the ones that it's just like you're not challenging each other. You're not learning. You're not really doing anything but just seeing who can say I know more instead of, you know, it doesn't matter if you know a lot. It doesn't matter if you're coming in and it's your first day talking astronomy. I think the most benefit comes to all of us as a community when you start asking the question, regardless of your foundational knowledge, what do you think?
Totally agree, Dustin. I wish so many people could have that same perspective. Just because for me, learning it was interesting looking back just because I was a newbie and a kid at the same time. So people just put me in the category of innocence and being, you know, naive. But really, we can all learn, whether we're just starting or we've been in it for, you know, 30, 40 years as a profession, and it's gotten old and boring, and you don't have the same invigorating feelings seeing, you know, your results pop up on the screen that you used to have. That either learning that passion and learning and relearning the love and finding that same oomph that you used to have, or learning from your elders. I think we all just need to kind of cultivate that more.
Yeah, and I just think there's so much, it's such a more interesting conversation, even when it's conversations that I just clearly disagree with. You know, people, you know, we've gotten a few, you guys were talking about before this thing started, flat earth, you know, we get some of the stuff like that, where people will say like, hey, I think the earth is flat and here's why. And it's always a more entertaining conversation to even hear something as absurd as that than the, hey, sit down, I'm about to unload everything I know on you.
Right.
And at the end of it, you can say, hey, cool story, man. You know, like,
cool story, bro.
Yeah, cool story, man. You tell it again? You're going to tell it again? Like, that's cool. Yeah, I just don't think, and I think that there's so much of that here that's just like, I know this, I know this, I know this. Let me dump this on you. And I see that a lot in clubs, not all clubs. I'm telling you, some clubs you walk in and it is a what do you think conversation. And that is the way people really learn. And that's the way we're going to learn more. And that's
really
what science
is
about.
It really is. There was a kid in my club that still inspires me to this day. He came up to me and asked me, he said, hey, do you want to know about the Oort cloud? And he's 10. I had no idea what the Oort cloud was when I was 10. And he proceeded to tell me all about it and wanted to know why and wanted to learn more about this. Now, if at that point I said, we need to start at the solar system. We need to start with planetary formation before we even begin Oort cloud. That could have squashed that. I mean, that's not okay. You need to go with what their passion is telling you where they want to be. Like for me, I was the obnoxious, you know, info sponge. I just wanted to know more and more and more. And so I honed down the physics professor in my club, and I told him that I knew that our star was in the main sequence state of its life. And I wanted him to explain fusion to me because I knew what hydrostatic equilibrium was. And I knew that gravity is pulling the star inward and the light pressure from all the fusion reactions in the star are pushing outward. But I had no idea what fusion was and I wanted to know why. And thank God he just looked at me and I guess admired my pinpoint interest in that one thing and decided to help me on it. And he's like, oh, wow, that's really cool. Sure, I'll tell you about that. But if he would have just, you know, laughed and was like, you need to know 101 physics before we go to that. Yeah. I mean,
you don't know that?
Yeah.
God, don't even waste my time.
Yeah.
Well, you know, look, I mean, look, you guys are raising some really good points here, but the bottom line is this, how these personalities that we're talking about react to these kinds of questions is everything. I mean, you alluded to early, Abby, that these are all Spock types, right? These are, you know, the personality types that get involved are of a very specific kind, and they generally don't tend to be very welcoming. And they are, you know, maybe the social skill department is a little bit low, but the way in which that you respond to these kind of questions, like your physics professor that you approached, is everything. And one of the things that I find very encouraging about what you've told us today is this story about you've got this youth astronomy club, one of the only in the country. That is the spark that is going to keep the astronomy club at large going. And the churn rate of astronomy clubs tends to be zero, right? You get these 20 guys who get together. Maybe it's not even 20, maybe it's five. They get together, they start an astronomy club, and they just sit around in a circle and talk to each other about their telescopes. And then they're done for the day. Maybe if it's clear, they'll go out and observe. And that's the club meeting, right? And so But someone else comes in and wants to ask about black holes, they just get annoyed. Well, you know, that's sort of where this crustiness makes the astronomy club kind of, you know, an anachronism, right? Nobody wants to go to astronomy clubs anymore. Yeah. Because of that.
And it's not, you can't say any, man. It's not any, you know, some of them are really, it's a good time. It's fun. And it's not like that. Yeah. It's not like that. Many are great. There are just.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I don't mean to say all of them, but there are plenty of stories of what we're talking about here. Where
and it's not just clubs, man. It's all groups. All groups have
all groups. I totally agree Facebook. With that.
Look at Facebook. You post a photo of anything. Look, I'm the first one to tell you. I cook the saturation on every image I have, and then I put it back in the oven and cook it again, you know, to make it as saturated as possible. It is offensive to people when they see it, you know, and
dude,
not
this
just
photo makes me mad.
Yeah, exactly. And everybody starts trying to define the line of that's not a photo, that's art. That's art. And it's just like, this is so upsetting to you. And it's hilarious to me that it's bothering
you mad, bro?
So much. It's like, where does this frustration come from? And
why? It's the puritanical type stance. It's like that in everything. Like, I was a ballerina almost my entire life. And you had a specific clothing. You had a specific, you know, hairdo. And if you wore your hair in a certain way that just slightly deviated from the norm, then you were like chastised. It was ridiculous. And it's the same like in piano. Like, there's certain songs that you play for competitions and others aren't accepted. And if you go in there with a jazz piece, God forbid, I mean, that's just what a scoundrel, you know?
Yeah. But I just love the standards, like these arbitrary standards that people come up with in their mind. They're like, well, did you touch the saturation slider for more than 300 milliseconds? If you did, this is no longer a valid photo.
Yeah.
And I'm going to report you.
You could just talk to the hand.
I got reported to the Facebook community managers for supporting a guy that they had, you know, they had warned this guy is, they considered this overprocessed. But, you know, people were beating up on a kid for this. It's just like, no, this is silly. This kid's photo is awesome. I'm jealous of it, as a matter of fact. It's better than anything I've ever taken. So this thing's awesome, and I'm going to say it's awesome. And people got so upset immediately that within 20 minutes of posting it, the community organizer or manager or whatever they are, they contacted me. They're like, look, we're not going to take the post down, but we did want to tell you that like it upset people that you posted this. And I just think it's so funny that people get upset about other people's creativity or their process with arbitrary guidelines that mean absolutely nothing. And these are the same people that will post a blurry picture of a light and then be like, hey, doesn't get more realistic than this. With my 2040 vision, this is what the moon looks like.
2040.
You know, like... Come on. What are these lines?
I think not just in the sense of passions and different, you know, scientific and creative outlets. That's taken, let's go back to, you know, like religion. Some people, you know, criticize and judge others for, you know, interpreting different Bibles and different religious texts in their own sense to find God. And I think what the problem is just ego, period.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and human nature. These two things, they just, you know, whenever there's a chance of like-minded people to get together, these rigid sort of thinking will just come out of it and calcify. And then next thing you know, you got to break through it. And it takes someone like yourself to go in and say, hey, I want to learn about all this cool stuff. And you break through the crustiness and you've got a great community there now, you know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It's so great. We have after meetings now. We go get ice cream
And you had to work to get there, though, didn't you?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, because I suggested that like 3 years ago. And they're like, oh, nah, I need to go home. I need to go feed my dog. And like, we have like 17 people go to Brahms now after our meetings at our ice cream shop. And they're like, oh, you go to Brahms? Yeah. Well, I'm going to bring this book. And I've got some of these photographs that I've been working on. Or be like, oh, yeah, so I'm going to bring these filters. I want your opinion. And it's invigorated them, and it's fantastic to see because you can see the little child kind of coming out and peeking its head out after being kept in the closet for years and years and years of its, the adult serious world. And now they can come out and kind of play again and see the light. It's great.
It's so funny that this is a thing, though. It's good that you broke through it. And I think that you're going to be able to do more and more of that. I think now that you, like, I'm sure as you see your following growing, you're probably getting a lot of direct messages from people. I would imagine you're inspiring a lot of young people, and females especially, which is great, to get into this hobby and to pursue it as a passion.
I have. It really has been such a fun process. And looking back, it's given me the chance to kind of review all of the projects and activities in astronomy over the past 5 years. It's given me pause, once again, to sit kind of where I'm at and be grateful for all of the support from my parents, my mentors, and my peers. And just that it kind of feeds it, right? So you get a positive reaction and it kind of conditions you in a sense. You're like, ooh, I want to do that again. So you do even more and you're like, ooh, they liked it. They want to know more. They want to learn. Let's do more. And it's just great. The key is just kind of put yourself out there, volunteer over and over and over again, no matter how foolish or vulnerable you feel. I mean, heck, I still get terrified talking in front of people, but I just kind of try to joke around, and some people don't get my sarcasm. Some people get offended by it, but it kind of is my crutch. It helps me get through it. But really, none of what has transpired would have been possible without, you know, all of my amazing people and their steadfast guidance and help and encouragement. And I just kind of want to be that for other girls, other kids, other people, no matter what age.
Well, Abigail Bollenbach, thank you for being Abby Normal. I appreciate your spending some time with us here on our podcast. It's been awesome talking to you. So Infinity and Beyond is your latest video series. It's out on the Astronomy Magazine's YouTube channel. So listeners need to go check that out. It's really good. And anything else you want to let our listeners know about that you're up to, Abby?
Trying to stay sane during this pandemic. If you guys have any tips, let me know.
Yeah, we all need those.
Okay. Better internet connection for all the Zoom meetings that I'm involved in.
Yes. So you'll be signing up for Starlink, I guess.
There's just so much going on. I work with Astronomy Magazine now, and I work at my chemistry lab, and I'm going to try to juggle that with astronomy and studying it in college with astrophysics, and hopefully obtaining a higher education and seeing how long Astronomy Magazine stays with me and has faith. But any other endeavors that I can kind of twist off and have fun with in between, I like this. I love doing stuff like this. You guys have been great. I so appreciate y'all listening to my funny experiences and your time and consideration.
Hey, you're welcome anytime. Well, we hope you'll come back and do another episode with us.
Oh, I'd love that. That'd be awesome.
Okay, great. Well, Abigail Bollenbach, she is a student, science communicator, and amateur astronomer, all rolled up into one. I'm excited to watch you grow and see what you end up getting yourself involved in. I wish you nothing but good things. So thank you for taking time out to join us here at Space Junk Podcast. On behalf of Dustin Gibson, I'm Tony Darnell. Thank you so much for listening. And as always, keep looking up. Space Junk is produced by Deep Astronomy and sponsored by OPT Telescopes in Carlsbad, California. Please visit our website at spacejunkpodcast.com. Also, please send any questions and comments or ideas for new episodes to spacejunk@deepastronomy.com.